My name is Kitty Roach, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I'd like to thank Harlan and the committee for inviting me. This is a beautiful place, and I've heard about you all from various people in the programs over the years, so I'm excited to be here. I got the opportunity at the same time to come up to visit my brother and his family. They live in White Salmon, Washington, so I came up last weekend and had a wonderful time with them, and my cuñada, my sister-in-law, drove me over here this weekend. She hasn't heard me talk, so I can't make anything up when she's here, so she knows too much about me. Anyway, thank you for inviting me. I have to say, I listened to Jerry this afternoon, and he was talking about the doohickeys here for identification and how he remembered them from his days in the various mental institutions, and how it felt kind of comforting to have it put on, you know. I was a psychiatric nurse, and I was horrified. Sorry, we just look like we're all out on pass. So much for that anonymity thing when you're walking around downtown. Anyway, my home group is the Tuesday Morning Experience Strength and Hope Al-Anon group in Carlsbad, California, and on January 9th of this year, I had 18 years of Al-Anon. I would have had 36, but I quit. I'm kind of an Al-Anon slipper. I came in and out a few times, and it took me a while to figure out that I really needed to be here. As Priscilla said, I am the child of an alcoholic. I don't want you to think that's my only claim to fame. I also have grandparents, siblings, cousins, aunts, uncles, children, friends, some teachers, and so I come here pretty honestly. I am the oldest of five in a normal alcoholic family. What my dad likes to call from the CIA, the Catholic Irish Alcoholics. And being the oldest of five, of course, there are things that go along with that that have nothing to do with an alcoholic family. When you're the oldest of a big family, you just get put in charge when you're about 10 months old. when the next one comes along, the Irish twin, who's my brother that lives in White Salmon. We're 10 and a half months apart. You do the math. And my dad always says every time he came out of a blackout, there was another kid. He had way more than five blackouts, I can tell you that right now. But maybe they're not, well, never mind. from a really early age, I remember feeling not as good as. I am not going to blame my folks. I am not going to say that they somehow put things on me, because I don't know the answer to that. I just know that from a very, very young age, made the decision of how to live my life by looking at you and judging which way to go. You know, I live my life by the look in your eyes. I'm sure part of that came from the unpredictability of living with an alcoholic father who is very physical. When he moved fast, you were either going to get smooched or smacked, and you just never knew. And so we all kind of have this little head movement, you know, trying to figure out what's going to happen. But I think that unpredictability gave me, you know, the need to kind of always tell what was going to happen. There was nothing I hated worse than not knowing that what was going to happen. I wanted plans. I wanted it all to go the way it was planned. I wanted no hiccups in it. Everybody needed to behave. Well, what fat chance, you know. Not only was I had an alcoholic father, but I had three siblings working on their story at 2 and 3 and 5, you know. So the more others misbehaved, I always like to say that, the more I tried to behave, okay, the more it was necessary for me to be perfect. You know, I was six. You know, there was no way. Now, my dad is a lot of fun, and as is my mother. They both have a grand sense of humor. We all do. From my dad, I think I get the kind of wee. I'm just going to talk over that because it happened through the other meetings, too. You know, this whole thing, though, I have to tell you, has a just frightening resemblance to one of my weddings. I can't remember which one. It's really kind of scary. And coming up the stairs was really hard. It was like, I have to walk under that. I should have come around. Sorry, I digress. If someone had only shot the groom, no. Sorry. Boom. I'm sure my dad would have been happy to. Forgot where I was. Anyway, we always had a lot of laughing in my house. It was a kind of a competition. Who could talk the fastest? Who could make the most jokes? Consequently, we all interrupt each other to this day, you know, because it was like, I'm on. And when I talk, when I share from the podium, one of the things I have to work really hard on is not performing for you, is talking from my heart, because I can get up here and be a ham. Every one of us can. It's keeping honest that's the hard part for me. I was a little liar by the time I could talk, you know. I told you what you wanted to hear. As if my life weren't exciting enough, I would make things up to make it more exciting, you know, because having a raging alcoholic wasn't good enough, apparently. You know, I was just, I don't even know some of the things. I can't, to tell you the truth, some of the things I tell now, I think, I wonder if that really happened or if I just convinced myself that that were true. I think after the fourth steps, I've gotten it down pretty well. But we had a lot of laughing. And in my house, we had a lot of laughing with jokes, but we also got from my mom. We had the Al-Anon meeting today. One of the meetings was on humor, and I was kind of thinking about the different kinds of humor. We had a lot of sarcasm in my family. And then if it hurt your feelings, you know, you can't take a joke. And, you know, it wasn't funny. It hurt. And it took me a lot of years to figure out that not only was I not being funny when I said it, but it wasn't funny to me. It was hurtful. But for my mom, I got a way of looking at life that if you're looking at a situation like this and you're thinking, oh, okay, I can't deal with this, you just go, oh, I can do that. Just the ironies of life I got from her, and I'm so appreciative of that, because to me that's what I had as a basis for growth when I came to Al-Anon, was that the ironies of life. When I was nine, my father had become a teacher, and we moved to Oceanside, California. And, oh, somebody's heard that talk. Do you know where Oceanside is? Anyway, I went to school, and I started, my dad's drinking started to get a lot worse as we grew, and my mother became more preoccupied with that drinking. Plus, we didn't have a lot of money, so she would teach piano lessons in the living room of our home, and I don't know how many students she had. It just seemed like she was always in there, and to this day, I kind of get a anxious stomach when I hear Zorba the Greek, you know, da 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 over and over by 17 students. Green sleeves also, can't do that either. Because on Mondays I would iron in the back of the house, that was my job, and listen to all the piano students. And you know, my dad wore white shirts for teaching, all had to be ironed. That was the first thing I rebelled against when I got older. Iron your own damn shirts. Didn't know I had that resentment for a long time. As time went on, I became more and more adept at kind of being who you all wanted. Now, I have a brother and sister that are real close to me in age. My brother David is 10 and a half months younger, and my sister Jan is 3 years younger. And from the very beginning, I feel, and I still feel today, we got kind of set up to not be close. I was the good kid, you know? such a goody-two-shoes. It was just nauseating. And we went to a Catholic school. And so I was first, and then my poor brother and sister would come behind me, and the nuns and everybody would say, why can't you be like your sister? You know, well, nobody could. I wasn't real, you know. I was what everybody wanted. And so naturally, they didn't like me very much because they were in trouble. Now, I'm not saying I was okay because I did a lot of really sneaky things and was really good. My younger sister, the middle sister, would just get fly off the handle, everything. We'd be doing the dishes. I always washed. She always dried. And I'd say under my breath something like how stupid she was. And she'd say, I'm not stupid, you stupid. Get out of here. And she'd come in and get grounded, you know. And I'd go, hey, you know, do my dishes. Cruel. It was cruel. On the other hand, there ought to be a little self-control on her part. She was working on her story, too. We fought all of the time. We fought all of the time. Barbies make wonderful weapons, for those of you who don't know that. They're very angular. They leave marks. And consequently, I felt really alienated from the rest of my siblings. Now, when the two youngest came along, the ones we call the kids, they were mine, because by that time, the drinking had gotten to a point where nobody was paying much attention on the parent side. I was 10 when my youngest sister was born, and 7 when my youngest brother. And I literally raised them through my teenage years. They were my kids. We have not one family movie or picture of me at that since about the age of 11 without my baby sister on my hip. It just attached, literally, at the hip. That's the way it was. When I started high school, where my dad taught, the drinking had gotten really, really bad. Now, I think as a kid, I'm not so sure I noticed it, really. I'm sure my mother did. I mean, you know, she was having to live with it on a little more intimate level. But my dad was really a lot of fun. You know, he'd take us out, we'd play cops and robbers. He just, you know, he wasn't that mature, so we got along really well. And as time went on, by the time I got to be about 12 or 13, at some point, I felt like I could change what was happening in our house. I wasn't really sure what it was, but I was afraid all the time. I didn't like myself. I knew that other people thought I was so great, you know, what a good kid, she's so great, and I knew how bad I was. You know, I just knew how bad I really was, and I had everybody fooled. When I was 17, I always like to tell this story just because it's, you know, people in these rooms appreciate this. That doesn't, normies don't get it, but when I was 17, it was the Christmas before my dad got sober, and my mother and I had been fighting for a long time. For those of you who grew up in an alcoholic household, I don't know how you felt, but I blamed the non-alcoholic. As far as I was concerned, she wasn't drunk, and she just damn well ought to fix it. And we'd been fighting quite a bit, and things were really, really bad. And it was, we had gone on the annual drunk driving Christmas light tour. On Christmas Eve. You remember. Look at the lights! Look at the lights! No seat belts in those days. 58 Chevy station wagon that my dad had painted green with house paint. Couldn't wait to inherit that car. So we, you know, we all get home on Christmas Eve and we're all a little carsick, and we come in, and in our family, the tradition is that you open your smallest present on Christmas Eve and then the rest of them on Christmas Day. And we did that, and we had just built on, now you'll know the year by this, we had just built on a family room with green shag carpet. All the rage. We opened our presents, and the kids had gone to bed, and my dad passed out face down on the green shag carpet in the family room, you know. On his face. And my mother said, damn it, I needed him to help me put together Chris's drum set. Now, I just want to point out here how sick she was, that you would buy in that house an 11-year-old a drum set. Oh, yeah, let's add to the noise. So I said, oh, I'll help you put it together. And by this time, you know, my dad's story is his story, but I can tell you that there was a lot of fear in that house, and he was not one of your alcoholics that sat in a chair and went to sleep watching television. He was had a lot of rage, and there was a lot of physical interaction. I don't know how to say it. I didn't get it as much as the other kids, which is another reason I was so alienated. I mean, I just always found a way to get out of it. Anyway, so I said, well, I'll help you. So we're sitting on the family room floor, and we're putting together the drum set, and my mother is screwing in the pedal to the bass drum, and her hand slipped, and it went boom. And my father levitated about 4 inches off the floor, all as one unit. Well, you know, we just froze in horror. I go, oh, don't wake him up. And luckily, he slept through it, or sleep being the euphemism. So we went back and started doing it again, and it happened again. Boom! Up and down. Well, then she started doing it on purpose. I told you. That's the kind of sense of humor. Well, we were laughing so hard. I mean, he must have gone up and down 8 times, you know. Just never came to. We had to crawl away from each other because we were just sick. We were laughing so hard. And, you know, it's just one of the most treasured memories of my childhood. You know, to be that close to my mom in that horrible situation. Now, I have to tell you, about 10 years ago, I was hosting the Christmas party for work. Maybe it was more than that, because 10 or 12. Because that was the Christmas my stepdaughter came home on acid. That was entertaining. And I tell this story, because it was Christmas time, and they mostly were social workers, some nurses, and they all looked at me and said, that's the most horrible thing I ever heard, you poor thing. I'm like, no, it's a good thing. So I learned never to tell that anywhere but here. Because you guys get it. Anyway, the next January, one of the famous after fight lines of my dad's was, fine, I'll just, you know, pack up and get out of here. And we all went, okay. And so he moved out and got sober shortly after. And then my mother came into Al-Anon the following March. Now, I was encouraged to go to Al-Anon. In North County, San Diego, at that time, we had one Al-Anon meeting. It was held in the same Alano Club as the AA meetings, which were above a dry cleaning establishment. I still think that's why the AAs picked it, because the fumes came up through the floor. But so I go in, I'm 17 years old, only going because my parents said, we think you should do this, and remember, I'm a, you know, good little girl. And I sat in a room with a bunch of old ladies who smoked cigarettes and who were all married to alcoholics. Well, you know, I had nothing in common. I had nothing in common. One of the things I always like to talk about is when I was growing up, my family really likes music. We're all into music. And some of us can sing, some can't, but it never stopped us. And my sister, who's 3 years younger, just to kind of add to the stress on the relationship, has a beautiful singing voice. She's little and blonde and can dance and, you know, I'm not any of those things, so... And when we were about 10, I was about 10, she was about 7. My mother took us for dancing lessons, because she really wanted that, and so did I. And I remember, and I've been told many times this is not what happened, but I remember, after about 3 lessons, the teacher saying to my mom, you know, you're kind of wasting your money there. Keep the young one, she knows what she's doing. But the older ones, you know. Now, that's what I heard, because I don't have a natural ability. Now, God forbid I should just go do something and have fun. You know, I couldn't do that yet. I had to be good at everything I did. And so Jan started doing tap dancing, and when the parties would get going at our house, they would roll up the rugs and drag my sister out to dance for everybody, and she would dance to Georgie Girl. Hey there, Georgie Girl. A little tap dancing for all the drunks. And whoever else was there. And I would lie in bed and I would cry because I didn't have any talent. And nobody was, you know, what are they going to drag me out and show me how good, you know, she's very well behaved. Watch. You know. And I would cry. And one night my mom was coming through the room, it had two doors, and asked me why I was crying. And I said, I have no talent. You know, I can't do anything. I'm not any good at anything. And she rubbed my back and she said, oh, sweetie, you have hidden talents. I thought, well, get the bulldozer because they're way down there. And I thought, oh, she's a good mom. She wants me to feel better. You know, she doesn't understand that there's really nothing I can do and nobody knows that but me. Well, after my parents came into AA and Al-Anon, I don't know what they heard, but for some reason they felt they needed to take the parenting duties back of the other children. And I thought, well, I don't think so. Doing a perfectly fine job, thank you very much. And as time went on, I graduated from high school, I started college, and they took back more and more of what they should have had to begin with, what they were supposed to do. And every single piece of identity I had was tied up in that. You know, if I wasn't the one who took care of everything, if I wasn't the one who had the kids, if I wasn't the good girl, then who was I? I wasn't anybody. No, I wasn't anybody. So when I went to Al-Anon with my mom, I saw nothing there for me. Number one, there were just these old ladies who were like probably 15 years younger than I am now, but when you're 17, you know, and they all smoked. And what I heard was, you're here because you're crazy, and because you're powerless, and because you need help. And I thought, well, it's pretty darn clear all of them are here for that, you know, but I'm the one that held the family together. What are they talking about? So I didn't go very long, and by this time I had discovered to quit, I had figured out to quit looking for myself in my family's eyes and started looking for it in men's eyes. Always had to be external. So I had the first great love of my life around that time. And he died of testicular cancer when he was quite young. And I moved, I just lost it. And I moved away and moved to the Santa Cruz Mountains to a commune. Now, mind you, I'd been trying to get privacy for all of my life. So I went and lived with 50 people in a small cabin. And immediately hooked up with a young man with lots of potential. His potential had to do with the variety of drugs he could use, but what the hell. And my father was, I mean, and my whole family were like, oh, we don't even know who you are. You know, we don't even know who you are. I was really not a very good hippie. I have the hair, and I liked the clothes. But I always worked, and, you know, my family is, I hate to even admit to this because they're so ashamed, but, you know, I'm not alcoholic. So I don't do drugs worth a damn either. My father actually introduces me as his daughter who couldn't make it as an alcoholic. I have to tell you, in those years, I gave it a good shot. I tried really hard. And let me tell you, maybe this is a secret to you, maybe it's not. The hole that you all, when I hear you talk about when you drank, when I hear you talk talk about what it felt like when you drank. I can't identify with the change that comes over you. It never has done for me that. What I can identify with is the hole, the endless emptiness that you feel that the alcohol for you fills. Okay? It never did that for me. I used to wish it did that for me. I had nothing, just that hole, you know? So I hooked up with this guy, and I hadn't really been around drugs too much, not because they weren't around, you know, my high school and my siblings, but because I was the goody two-shoes, so, you know, I never went near that stuff. But he said, you know, if you loved me, you would do this with me. So I went, all right, obviously I love you, so. Acid, you know, I took once, and then I learned to fake it after that because it was horrible. I liked pot a little bit, but mostly only because then I could eat more. But I tried a lot of stuff, and I compromised every piece of integrity that I had because of him. You know, I knew that was all wrong. I knew that selling drugs was wrong. I knew that these people were not healthy people, but it's what he wanted. And a lot of things happened in my house as a young woman married to this man that I look back on today and I think, I don't know who the hell you were, but what a dumbass, you know? What a sick dumbass. He had a friend come visit from Michigan. He was from Michigan. And who was an escaped felon, you know, had broken out of the chain gang and showed up in California. And, you know, for a long time I denied that I even knew about that, even though he showed up in an orange jumpsuit, you know. It was in, that neon color was in at the time, so I didn't know. My ex-husband would make these brilliant drug deals, you know, and then the drugs would get stolen, no kidding. And I even helped with that because he clearly couldn't manage that correctly. You know, I got in on that. And I did a lot of things that were completely against every belief that I have. That's what my disease did to me, you know. We moved back down into near where my parents live. I had gone to nursing school. Through all this, I had managed to get through nursing school. Education was a big deal. And I got my first nursing job after we moved back down there, and it was as a psychiatric nurse. Who knew? I always thought, boy, I got stuff on, and I'm not even on the resume that qualifies me for this. And I loved it. I loved it. I was so good at it. And right around this time, I started going to Al-Anon again, and shortly thereafter, and I had some support, you know, from my folks and the family, and shortly thereafter, there was a very ugly, physical, abusive incident with my ex, which had never happened before, and I said, okay, that's it. I can't do this anymore. I'm not going to stay in these conditions, and we got divorced. In the meantime, I found this really neat group of people I worked with. I was going back to Al-Anon. Things were looking pretty good. However, I never bought in on the spiritual part of it. You know, I had two higher powers growing up, my dad and the higher power of my church. And as far as I was concerned, neither one had done a very good job. And I wanted nothing to do with it. So I did what I had always done all of my life for those 2 years that I was in Al-Anon, sponsoring everything, is I faked it. You know? Yes, I'm turning my life over. You know? I mean, I just did the dance. I just did the dance. And I was in terrible pain. Terrible pain. My sponsor, first time I did a fourth step, it sounded like confession. You know, I lied 3 times, I did this 4 times. She said, we'll try again a little later. Okay. Anyway, one day at work, I worked the evening shift, the cops brought in a man who had done PCP. Now, I tried that too and I went to sleep. Does that make any sense to you? Didn't do a thing. Anyway, the cops would bring them into the locked unit prior to transporting them down to the county hospital, and usually they'd walk them into the locked room and take their cuffs off, only this time they took them off in the locked unit, but not in the locked room. And I don't know if you've had any experience with this drug, But it, little people never take it. Just great, big, huge men that can hurt you. And so here's this guy. He's pretty pissed off anyway, and he's on this drug, and he gets away, and he rips a wooden dowel out of the closet in one of the rooms, and he's holding everybody at bay. You know, we have all these people in this unit, and we're trying to figure out what to do. And it took me about 45 minutes, but I talked him down. We walked into the seclusion room. He agreed to lie down and take medications if we didn't restrain him. Gave him his medication, came out, and I was in the bathroom after that because it's a kind of a jittery experience when the adrenaline wears off. And I looked in the mirror and I thought, it's my hidden talent. And it's the first time I had a glimmer that what was inside me might be enough. Might be enough. That it didn't have to be on the outside, that talent is something that comes from the inside. Perhaps not really useful at parties. Sometimes it has been. I moved back to the San Francisco Bay Area to get my bachelor's degree and met another man with potential. And we were married for 15 years. And it was a good marriage for a long time. Now, by this time, my sister and two of my brothers and my sister were kind of in and out of AA. We used to make fun of AA. You know, we'd go to see Dad get his cakes and everybody be stoned. And then Dad would say, we're saving you a chair. Yeah. Good thing he did. Now we're working on the next generation. But anyway, I have these two stepdaughters that came with the marriage. I had always chosen not to have children because I felt like I'd raised them already, and my job was very demanding. And I had these two stepdaughters. Well, when I moved up to the Bay Area, I had very little Al-Anon, and don't forget, I had never really turned anything over. And I called her our ex-wife. That's how enmeshed I was with that. Our ex-wife had some problems. You know how ex-wives are. Being one, I should know. But he had two little kids, and I immediately got right in the middle of that. You know, they can't communicate, so therefore I must do that. And so for the next few years I did, and plus the Al-Anon up there wasn't really good Al-Anon. You know how when you move away, they don't do it right, so you can't go. And I wasn't married to an alcoholic, so, and all my alcoholics were down there, so what was the use? And so I did a lot of damage in that relationship with those girls. I did a lot of damage because I kept trying to fix it. Had I ever allowed the two of them to actually talk it out, there might have been some chance. Now, the other part of it is, of course, God forbid that their dad and them should talk. I was like, well, here's what he really meant. No, here's what she really meant. Here's what, anyway. And that's what happened during those years. I don't mean to skip a lot through that marriage, but it was kind of boring there for a while. No, not really. Anyway, it was a pretty decent marriage for as sick as I was. And I tried really hard to be a good stepmother. Being a stepmother is really, really hard. It's the hardest job I ever had. And at this point, I had even given up trying to find God. You know, I had even given up even thinking that was a possibility. When my dad talks, he talks about if somebody asked him why he drank, he would say, for the 8 minutes of peace that I get between the third and fourth drink. That's why. And I used to think, I'd hear him do his talk, and I'd think, I never get any stinking 8 minutes. You know? It's always there. It's just always there. Fear. Just nothing but fear. We moved back down to the Oceanside area again. And I got a job as a public health nurse, which I just loved. It was very much like being a psychiatric nurse, except you go in their home and you have no backup and no meds. What a culture shock that was. You know, I had always been the keeper of the keys. I was the charge nurse. You know, I said whether you went out or came back in. Can't all of you who've been there, I'm sure you loved the likes of me. No control issues there. Meanwhile, people are starting to get sober down there, you know, in my neck of the woods. So we move back down, and now in this job, it's sort of like, well, you go out and you tell them what their alternatives are, and then you let them decide. It's like, well, you're kidding me, right? You know, they don't even know what they're doing. So I started that job, and I loved it. Now, my ex-husband, second ex-husband, is not an alcoholic. He doesn't call himself an alcoholic. His drinking was not a problem to me when we were married. But he went crazy somewhere around our maybe 12th year marriage. He got obsessed with having his own business. Now, he was a machinist, and he was a good machinist, but he was a crappy businessman, you know? Now, I've been in Al-Anon. Let me tell you how I came back to Al-Anon. Our ex-wife brought me here. When we moved back down, the kids would come fly down and visit, and every time there was some big scene, every time, when I'm not sending them, we'd wait and hope they got off the plane, you know, it was just awful. Well, one year she decided not to have them come back. I'm arguing with her about, I can't just enroll them in school for 2 weeks and then send them back, you know, it's not going to work. So we get off the phone, and I'm in the shower getting ready to go somewhere, and I got this pain in my head, and I think, oh my God, I'm having a stroke, and she isn't going to give one crap. And I thought, I don't want to live this way anymore, and I went to a meeting that night, and that was January 9th of 1988, and so I hate to give her the credit, but here we are, 18 years later. I came back to Al-Anon, so things had been going pretty well, and then two things happened at once. My youngest stepdaughter came to live with us at the age of 13. She started drinking at 11. She was coming home from school one day with a friend, and they saw a refrigerator in somebody's garage, and so she went and opened it, and it had a bottle of wine, so she drank it. That was it, you know. And then my ex-husband got obsessed with this machine thing he was going to do. Well, I was busy doing too much. I was district rep. I was working full-time, I was getting a master's degree, and I was president of the homeowners. I know. My sponsor says I can't make any more decisions without calling her for things like that anymore. And so I have this kid living there, and then this is going on. And so, as my ex would say to me, I want to do this, and I'd say, okay, but you need to stay at the job where you are now just enough so that, you know, we have some money till you know what's going to happen. And he'd say, okay. And then 2 weeks later, he would say, I think I'm just going to go on unemployment while I build this up. And I'd say, okay, but you need to stay on the unemployment while you build this up. And then 2 weeks later, he'd say, well, I got this job. And anyway, in the meantime, my youngest stepdaughter was living with us, and, you know, I love her dearly, but it was really hard. You know, biological child or not, feeling so completely helpless over your child's disease has got to be the worst thing in the world. Worse than having a parent, worse than having a spouse as an alcoholic, worse than siblings, worse than anything, because your job is to keep your children safe. That's your job. And she... Boy, I'll tell you. You know, I have to be careful not to tell too many stories on her because I don't want to just use her as entertainment, but boy, she was pretty darn funny. One night we were sitting around and she was late, of course, and my husband said, I hope it's pot tonight so we can have some chocolate peanut butter cookies. This is how you learn to live with it. Well, if she's going to use, maybe she'll bake. You know. At the Christmas party I was telling you about, she came home. She was little bitty, really teensy, and she had dyed her hair all these colors, and then one day she shaved her head. And I can't tell you that story. But anyway, she came home with her little bald head. She looked kind of cute. She was so tiny, you know, a little face, petite. So she comes home with the bald head and nothing but pupils. And I got all my work coworkers in the house. And I went out in the kitchen and I said, "Hey, honey." And she says, "Hi." I said, "What'd you take?" She'd always tell you, "Acid. Are you all right? Uh-huh." So she kind of wandered through it and picked up some food and went back to her bedroom. And I went back and said, "Okay, I'll come check on you in a little while." She said, "I've been in Al-Anon about probably 7 or 8 years by now." She said, "Aren't you going to yell at me?" I said, "Oh, no, I learned a long time ago to wait till the next day to yell at you." When you have the headache. I have a friend, when her husband would get drunk, and he'd pass out, and she'd get up at 6 in the morning and run the vacuum right by his head. She said, "It's just more effective that way." We don't drink, but we're clever. Anyway, one of the professionals I was working with leaned over and said, "I think your daughter might be on something." "Oh, you think?" Trained professional that you are, you made that assessment. But it got to the point where at almost 15 years old, she was dealing drugs out of the house. We had some very scary incidents of people coming to collect their money. One time I was home by myself, and this really large man who clearly had taken some hard road in his life showed up and said that Teresa owed him $12,000 and that he wanted it. Nobody was home, and we had this black lab at the time that was afraid of everybody. And I had her by the collar, and she was barking, but she was trying to get away. Using my hidden talent, I said, "You better go, or I'll let her go." Whatever. And at that point, I said to my husband, "She has to leave. You know, we can't be doing this anymore. She has to leave. It's just too scary here." So we did make arrangements for her mother. By then, I forgot to say how come we had her. Her mother had gotten arrested for manufacturing crystal meth and had lammed it from the honor farm where she used to work. So she knew how to get out, I guess. So we made arrangements for her to go live with somebody, and within 2 weeks she ran away, and for 2 years she lived on the streets. We didn't know where she was for a lot. Sometimes she'd call, and we had to do that knowing that she might die. She got sober when she was 17, and she's living in Arizona with her husband and their 6-year-old child, and she's a nurse. I know. He's a cop, which just cracks me up. "Oh, you're marrying a cop?" She said, "Yeah, what?" Then one day she said to me, "You know, we're raising Timmy as her son. We're raising him to be, you know, really well behaved, like, you know, to not run away and stuff." And I said, "Yeah, because we brought you up to do that." <You know>? Now be sure you get on the bus every chance you get. Oh my God, she kills me. But I don't ever want to hear her story. I don't want to know what it was like for her on the streets, you know? I'm glad she's sober. Anyway, at some point, my husband came to me. We had always had separate money. So he would give me money every month for the regular household bills, and then we each had our own credit cards and all that. And he came to me one day and he said, "I can't pay my half of the bills." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because I've been using my credit cards to pay them, and I'm really in debt." And then it turned out that he had like $80,000 in credit card bills that I knew nothing about. He had taken retirement money out of his retirement that was community property and forged my name, $25,000, and did not pay taxes. And I looked at him and I thought, what the hell happened here? You know. So naturally, you know, I was pretty upset. And when I tried to get any kind of a response about how this happened, all I got was this, "It was my dream," kind of thing in it. And he was indifferent to how it affected me, this man I had lived with for 13, 14 years. It wasn't that he meant to hurt me. It was that he didn't think of me. He was completely indifferent to the fact that we were going to have to declare bankruptcy, we might lose our house, that he had lied and manipulated and deceived and broken the law, you know, without any kind of what appeared to be a conscience, you know, and he wasn't drinking. And I spent some time trying to figure out how this happened in a number of ways. Number one, how could someone who says he loved me do this? And how could I have allowed this to have gotten here, you know, after all I'd learned in Al-Anon? And I was talking to my mom, and she said, honey, if you throw a frog into a boiling pot of water, it will die. If you put a frog in a tepid pot of water and slowly turn up the heat, you know, it will die because it gets used to it. I'm sorry, it's supposed to be the frog jumps out, but you got it. And I had done it again. I had compromised little by little by little. If you loved me, you would put money into the business. If you loved me, you would do this or that. If you loved me. And this was after years of Al-Anon and working the steps. Now, I had finally found a higher power, and it was kind of an accident. I was sitting in a meeting one day and heard the words, God as you understand him. And I thought, oh, they should have put that in the first time. I mean, I get to pick, you know. I get to make my higher power what it needs to be. I was like, oh, finally they put that in. And so I had developed a higher power. It took me a long time. It started at the group level. You know, sometimes it was just my sponsor. I knew she knew more than I did. The group knew more than I did, and I've, you know, really come to believe in a higher power that I have a lot of faith in, and by then I had done that, and was able to accept what was there at the time, you know, and learn from it. I could not stay married to him because I had no respect left, and felt he had none for me. To this day, he does not understand. You know, he says, but, you know. He owes me thousands of dollars, and I have quit trying to collect it. I've just needed to move on from that. But he, when I bought my, we went through the bankruptcy, we did a short sale on the house, it's taken, my bankruptcy's finally cleared in the end of February. I was so happy. I had such good credit before. When I bought my new condo, he sent me a card with a $25 check for me to go buy myself something for the house. What do you do with that but laugh? You know, like, thank you, dear. My relationship with my kids isn't all that I would like it to be. I guess they felt they needed to take sides in the divorce. But I love them, and I do my part. You know, I send the letters, I send the Christmas stuff and emails, etc. I have a fabulous relationship with my family today. There is no group of people I would rather be with than my siblings and my parents. When the five kids get together, the poor in-laws, you know, they're all kind of on the fringe because nobody, even after all these years, nobody gets all the jokes. We laugh so hard, it's the most healing thing in the world. I have a brother who I thought would die from this disease, who about 5.5, 6 years ago I had surrendered him because I was sure he would die. Horrible, horrible disease. I have two grandmothers that died of this disease, a cousin, and I thought I was going to lose my brother. But through the miracles is all I can say. In March, he had 5 years sobriety. My sister was sober for a long time and went out using pain pills. I think that's maybe the biggest fear today is the Vicodin. And then you know what? It was so sad. She's taking the pills, which, you know, is really hard. You can't tell. You know, they're like, okay, is she on something? Is she not? You can't smell it. Then when she went out, she drank $1.99 peach Chardonnay, for God's sakes. You know? It's like, I gotta bought you a good bottle. You know? She said, yeah, we don't care. Okay. My brother has 18 years, my youngest brother. This is my brother who said to me, geez, you can't drink worth a damn, can you? And I said, no, I never could. I, you know, I just throw up. And he'd say, well, you get past that. Like I was an underachiever. And then my baby sister, who is one of the Al-Anons. Today, I don't try to be perfect anymore. I actually enjoy it when I can laugh at myself. You know, I could always laugh at you. And frankly, you know, being around alcoholics all my life and then working as a psych nurse, it was pretty darn easy to quit not looking at me. You know, when you're a psych nurse, you look pretty good. It didn't matter how messed up you were. And, the you know, you alcoholics can be pretty darn entertaining, too. And when sobriety occurs, sometimes that's when the problems in the family really start to show up. I do want to say one thing that I always try to say. For those of you who are parents, and you have a good kid in your family, don't assume that that good kid's okay. You know? When we got sober, when our family started to get sober, my dad got sober, my mom, the focus came off of the alcoholic and looked down at the kids who were, it was sort of like, oh, holy moly, look at this mess. And the focus then went to the kids who were getting arrested and, you know, et cetera. Don't assume that your good kid is all right, you know. I was about as damaged, I think, as anybody could be. I just did it a different way. And that hole finally got filled when I found a higher power, you know, because that's the only way that hole gets filled for us. Whether you're alcoholic, Al-Anon, in my opinion, for anybody, is with a spiritual filling. I really try hard to practice these principles in all my affairs. There are days I don't do that. We were laughing at dinner about why Al-Anons do their birthdays on the days they came to Al-Anon and stayed. It's because we can't get through a day without a slip. You know, whoops, 2.5 hours, got to start over. The difference is every time pretty much that I know that I've spread my disease, I get to catch it. You know, that 10th step's a great one. That 10th step. Every night before I go to sleep, I do a 10th step, quick 10th step, and a gratitude list. And as life goes on and my work and my program goes on, I'm so glad that the gratitude list gets longer than the 10th step list, you know? I love my job. I've been single for quite a while. I might live in sin again. I will never get married again. That wasn't an offer, but, you know. You know, and it's not because I'm even bitter. It's just because because I can go now by what I know what I need to do. I make decisions with integrity. I check with others. I don't make decisions like here, you know. I have a fabulous sponsor. I have a loving family, and I get to come and do things like this and meet all of you. Before I close, there's a book in Al-Anon called From Survival to Recovery, and it is stories from children of alcoholics. And in the back of the book, there's a section about what happens when you work the steps of this program and participate as a full member of Al-Anon. And one of the quotes in there is, if you do what you're supposed to do, if you believe and have faith, you will find your hidden talents. Now, obviously, that book was not around when I was 10 years old, you know? So I can only believe that the power behind those words that my mom said were not hers. The first time that she and I read that, we just started to cry, you know? You will find your hidden talents. And every day, I am so grateful that they are, at least they are not hidden to me. You know, I know what they are. I know what my gifts are. And because of this program, I get to know what yours are too. Thank you.